You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Fairhead. A $400 million casino complex in Beloit is a big step closer to becoming a reality. Coming up, we'll look at the scope of the Ho-Chunk Nation project and what it would mean for Native American tribes in Wisconsin and for the community in the region. Now, in 2020, inmate populations in Wisconsin's jails and prisons dropped significantly. That's according to a new report from the Wisconsin Policy Forum looking at the impacts of the pandemic on incarceration. We're going to dive into that report, then we'll look at what the news can mean for wider efforts toward criminal justice reform. You can join in at 800-642-1234. What questions do you have for about how the pandemic hit prisons and jails in Wisconsin? Do you have a personal connection or interest in the state's criminal justice system? What do you think of the idea of trying to reduce the overall population of people in Wisconsin in jails or prisons? If you like that idea, how do we do it? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or email ideas@WPR.org. We start the conversation with Jason Stein, Research Director with the Wisconsin Policy Forum. Jason, welcome back to Central Time.
Thanks for having me, Rob.
How big were the drops you found in the report for jail and prison populations in the state?
Sure. Well, jails dropped precipitously, you know, just in the April and May, right after the pandemic really hit, and they dropped 35% statewide and in most counties statewide, and then picked up somewhat since then, but they are still 24% below, you know, the same month last year, so as of December. Now, on the state prison side, their inmate populations have been falling just more steadily and not by as much, and they are a little less than 16% below, you know, in February 2020, below where they were in February 21, they're 16% below February 2020. That's what I'm telling you. Trying to tell you, Rob.
And I could see a couple of things causing that. It could mean that more people are being released from jail or prison, and it could mean that fewer people are being sent there in the first place. Do we have a sense of how much of either side of the equation that is?
It's really kind of two different stories between local jails and prisons. In local jails, a number of inmates or people in custody were released initially and quickly to reduce the population in the jails and slow the spread of the virus. You know, and those individuals may have been placed under pretrial supervision or electronic monitoring, you know, some form of local supervision. At the state level, there was not as much, it's not as much a case that there was just an immediate letting people out. There was an emergency order that was signed by the governor in March of 2020 that put a moratorium on new admissions to try and prevent the, you know, entry of COVID-19 into the prisons. And so to some degree, there's still a backlog of like 1,200 or 1,300 male inmates who have been sentenced to prison, but they haven't yet been transferred from county jails. So in that sense, there's actually some people in county jails that would typically already be in prison. And then we've also seen court trials slow during the pandemic, which, you know, certainly reduces the number of people in state prisons because it reduces convictions. It may have a sort of differing effect at the jail level. There may be, in some cases, more people awaiting trial in jail. And then finally, there are some just policy changes that have been made at the state and local level to reduce populations in recent years. Like at the state level, there's been changes to that result in fewer people who are on extended supervision being revoked and returned to prison for either a new crime or just a violation of the terms of their release.
One more part of the story here in this report, spending per capita, I guess, per inmate went up last year. I'll go out on a limb. Is that partly for health precautions, or what is driving that?
Well, you know, I don't know that we have spent. We looked at spending data that was through 2017, so we don't have real solid spending data for the real time period of the pandemic yet. But I think it's reasonable to think that we would not have seen a huge drop in spending, because There's probably some savings in areas like food, medical care, certain programming that's sort of given on to inmates on a more individual group basis. But when you think about just what is the nature of a jail and prison, I mean, they have to be staffed 24/7. You know, if you still have, unless you can do something like close the wing of a prison, you can't necessarily get any savings from just having fewer people in this institution that you're staffing on a 24/7 basis.
Jason, thanks a lot for sharing this with us today.
Oh, my pleasure, Rob. Thanks for having me.
That's Jason Stein, Research Director for the Wisconsin Policy Forum. Now I'll bring on Ion Main, Assistant Professor at the UW Law School in Madison. He researches the influence of race and class-based disparities in civil and criminal settings. Ion, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
Well, this strikes me as kind of an unintentional, unplanned experiment in what I think they call decarceration, getting people out of the prison system. As you look at these numbers in Wisconsin and around the country, what is on your mind as someone who researches related issues?
I mean, there's so much on my mind, and I appreciate you discussing this issue, and thank you to your listeners for being part of this discussion. It's an important time, and so much is happening. Even in the past year, I'm part of kind of policy groups that are looking at ways of changing traditional ways that we have approached what we view as criminal justice issues. And the ideas are starting to sound what some people would say radical, other people would say long due. But as you know, and others know, there is really, in many respects, a bipartisan kind of agreement that we have reached a point of crisis. And I think it's things like this where, as Jason was saying, there's a 15% drop, for example, in Wisconsin prisons because of COVID. And we'll see soon what the studies are that come out of whether people's concerned about whether a crime has gone up, whether there are some public safety issues that are negative because of a reduction in prison. I'm not a betting man, but I will say there will not be any kind of problems, because in my view, at this point, we have so many people in prison that the criminal system now is actually undermining, from my perspective, public safety. And I'm not alone in thinking this.
The criminal justice system is undermining public safety, which I think is the opposite of what people might think it's doing or there to do. Can you talk about why that would be?
Yeah, you know, there's a number of sociologists now that have been looking at this from a number of years. 2009 was our high point. We've been, you know, decreasing a bit since then. It's still way, way, way above historical averages of incarceration rates. If you look at between 1925 and 1974, the incarceration rate stayed steady. It stayed at about 100,000 were incarcerated. We are now five times that rate. We could cut, in order to get down to, say, our historical kind of steady incarceration rate, we would have to cut our prisons and jails by 80%. Now, it's shocking to me to think that during Jim Crow, the incarceration rate was 80% less than it is now. And I don't understand how we could think that incarcerating so many people and the number of people it affects on the outside when you incarcerate somebody, you alter their life forever because they might be a felon and they're not going to be permitted to live where they want to live. They're not going to be able to work where they want to work. Their families will be hit with that financial aspect and that uncertainty that creates, that the financial uncertainty creates, including homelessness, including lower education rates. And so when you incarcerate someone, you are, as the state, creating an act of violence against an individual and the people connected to that individual. And so if we are going to commit an act of violence, for example, if I put you in a cage, I'm sure you'd view that as an act of violence. If we're going to commit an act of violence against someone, we better have really good reasons for doing so. And they have better have done something so severe that that's the kind of social response we should consider. unfortunately, we've normalized a violent way of responding to people who may be engaged in unlawful conduct, but certainly prison is not the response that's going to be in any way securing my safety, your safety, public order, and permitting people to actually meet their potential as humans. And so we've normalized what is radical and extreme. And so we have to rethink about how we approach, how we invest and create healthy communities. And I do not think, and many people agree with me, that prison is the way to do that.
We're talking to Ian Main, an assistant professor at the UW Law School in Madison. We're looking at findings from a new report by the Wisconsin Policy Forum on declines in prison and jail populations in Wisconsin in 2020 and the future of our criminal justice system, how we make decisions about who to incarcerate in the first place. You can join in at 800-642-1234. What's your response to hearing these findings about lower inmate populations, in large part as a response to the COVID emergency? Glad to see those numbers go down, hoping that it'll continue that way, or do you think it might have happened too quickly? Do you have worries about public safety? Do you have experience in the criminal justice system, maybe as an inmate yourself? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or email ideas@WPR.org. We'll continue the conversation coming up on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We're picking up our talk about criminal justice in Wisconsin with Ian Main, assistant professor at the UW Law School. We're talking about a decline in prison and jail numbers in Wisconsin in 2020, due in part to the COVID pandemic, and looking at the future of our criminal justice system. Who gets incarcerated? Do we rely too much on jails and prisons? Do you have an experience as an inmate yourself, as someone who worked with them as a social worker? 800-642-1234 is the number to call. Let's go to your calls now. John is with us in Elkhorn. John, hi.
Hello. I have quite a bit of experience, actually. I committed a crime in 92 and basically got off of parole in 2016. I spent almost 14 years in prison. And during that time, I did as many programs as I could. I went to college, though the professors came to the University of Green Bay, from University of Green Bay to Green Bay Prison. And I graduated from UW-Milwaukee just in 2016. With a degree. And I've seen in the years that I was in, from going in to coming out, I saw a huge influx of population and a decrease in all the programs that would help guys when they would get out so they didn't come back. I mean, Green Bay had over 14 vocational programs when I went there in 93, and by the time I left, they had two. And I left there 5 years after I got there and went to Medium, to Oshkosh. But since I've been out and since I got off parole in 2016, I've seen several guys that have gone back just from the fact that they can't make it out here. People won't hire. I mean, I have 2 degrees and I can't get a job because people look at me as a felon and that's all they see, even though it's been 30 years.
John, thanks a lot for sharing your story. I appreciate it. And good luck into you in finding a job. Ian, a lot there. Can you talk about John's story and the difficulty after someone's been incarcerated of, as John says, finding a job, getting training while they're there, and after, there's a lot to work on.
Yeah, it's heartbreaking. And John, I thank you for sharing your story, and I appreciate you telling everyone else about how hard it is out there. And for a lot of people, I'm glad you spoke out. For a lot of people, it's an issue that's they're really ashamed about, and they shouldn't be. They paid their debt to society and they should be able to work like anyone else, and their aspirations and their dreams hopefully are met. Economically, it's really, really brutal. About 90% of employers will definitely check if someone has a criminal background. That will be disqualifying, and it's disqualifying in two ways. You don't hear back, or you're told that because, say, you have a felony conviction, you are not going to be hired there. That also extends to housing. And a lot of people aren't able to find housing they need and find secure housing, which is essential to living a productive life. to having relationships that are important. You need to have financial security to have relationships, to raise a family in an environment that's safe and that feels secure. And so all those things are so important. And yet, and this doesn't speak to John's issue, but across the board, it is so easy to get a felony. And I have seen people with drug possession for the second time, their misdemeanor is turned into a felony for the rest of their life. They are going to have a hard time finding employment and being a productive member of society because they possess marijuana or paraphernalia for smoking marijuana twice. And to me, I just don't see how that in any way strengthens our society and moves along in terms of progress. I just don't see it.
Thanks a lot for that call and sharing your story. We'll go to Steve now in Manitowoc. Steve, hi.
Hi. I was a great subject, great topic. I often wonder that if the resistance to criminal justice reform is because there are moneyed interests that make money off of incarceration. What are your thoughts?
Steve, thanks for the call. People talk about private prisons, for example. I don't think we have any of those here in Wisconsin, but are there, I guess, financial or economic incentives for keeping prison populations large, Steve is asking.
Yeah, Steve, great question. I'm glad you raised that there are moneyed interests. In fact, the American Bar Association has been discussing a resolution to support the prohibition of private prisons because the incentive should not be to make sure that you have beds filled with inmates. That is a perverse kind of incentive. A number of people are thinking and writing about exactly what you're raising, calling it the industrial prison complex. You have vested interests, strong lobbies, both in terms of unions, both in terms of government actors who, there's federal funding that comes into areas, will help fund a prison in your county. People are hurting in that county economically, and it becomes a boon, and they become dependent on the prison. And that's not the kind of structure or architecture that's going to, again, or the kind of infrastructure that's going to lead to long-term kind of viability and success. But I understand the pressure that various places feel. And when they're faced with the idea of an attractive federally built or state built funded system that's going to create employment, I see the incentive. But to all those jurisdictions out there, resist it and push back, because it just is not the way forward.
Thanks for the call. We had a call from Fred who couldn't stay on the line, wanted to bring up concerns about victims' rights and worries about repeat offenders that could get lost in the shuffle if we're too, I guess, quick to release people from prison or lower punishments. What would you say to those concerns?
Yeah, I think those are always important concerns. And I think it's really important to listen to victims of violent crime and what they want. And there's a lot of work in this area, and I'm glad that was brought up. And in terms of what victims want, honestly, that's not discussed that much, and it's not discussed with victims. For example, a lot of victims feel like their needs are not being met regardless of what happens within this particular system. There are some really, really powerful and interesting programs that are being piloted now in New York and other places, in which even in where there's been a violent incident and you have the agreement of the victim, that there is a mediation and, a restorative justice approach. And the victim asks for it. The victim wants that road forward. And providing victims that option is a really powerful tool to give power back to the victim. A lot of victims after a traumatic crime or a violent act feel powerless. And one of the best things we can do is protect the victim and create a structure that gives power back to that victim. And in the traditional, there's prosecutors who are working really, really hard. And many times their caseload's so high, there's so much pressure, they can't attend to the victim. And so the victim feels powerless throughout the process. In terms of repeat offenders, that's a big question. In terms of violent crimes, it's important but statistically very small portion of all the crimes out there. So it's also important when we think about crime, we think about the full spectrum, and most of it is happening at the misdemeanor level. We have 12 million people cycle through jails a year. Very few of those statistically are violent crimes. So the question and the concern is absolutely important. I think we should always be listening to victims and making sure that as much as we can, we attend to the needs of victims who have been hurt. But at the same time, think about the criminal system as it actually is, which is mostly nonviolent crimes that then still lead to long periods of incarceration.
In our last minute or so, Ian, where do you think we should be starting to look at changes to reduce this reliance on incarceration?
You know, I think this is really an exciting space, and I hope the listeners really think about talking to their community leaders about programs like this. But there are places in Washington and Colorado, in Texas and Arizona, who are completely changing the way they approach problems, especially those misdemeanors and low-level crimes. In which that instead of a response team that's police, the response team are social workers. And these have been piloted in operation for some places as long as 20 years, but it's something that's happening in the last 2 years. So that when a call goes to dispatch, rather than the police responding, a social worker responds and then builds really strong networks with the surrounding kind of social networks that create and help bring that person into a productive space. That's a really exciting place. And I think a really another exciting place is in the pretrial detention place, where judges, certainly places like Milwaukee, are really, really attempting to rethink how they approach it and make sure that they allow people the freedom they need to connect with their families and get that strength and maybe avoid a criminal outcome.
Really, Ian, we'll leave it there.
Thank you so much.
Thank you. Yeah. That's Ian Main, assistant professor at UW's law school. We talked about a decline in prison populations in Wisconsin last year and looked ahead at the future. I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, we'll look at the possible long-term impacts of COVID-19 on our brains. Now, plans for a casino complex in Beloit are a step closer to becoming reality. This week, Governor Evers signed off on the Ho-Chunk Nation's $405 million project. It would be one of the bigger casinos in Wisconsin. The tribe first applied for an off-reservation casino in 2012. In a statement, Governor Evers said the project would create jobs and long-term economic growth in Beloit and Rock County, a sentiment echoed by Ho-Chunk Nation Public Relations Officer Ryan Greendeer.
Right now, jobs is a central focus in the Ho-Chunk Nation. We're trying to build our economy, and this is going to be the cornerstone of the economic recovery from the pandemic. We're really excited about the amount of jobs this creates, not just for Ho-Chunk people, too, because this will be a fantastic asset in the greater Beloit community.
While the project got the green light from Evers, it's not quite a done deal yet. So what's next? Danielle Kading is a reporter for Wisconsin Public Radio's for Wisconsin Public Radio. Danny, welcome back to the show.
Thanks for having me on, Rob.
Danny, tell us what this proposed complex would look like.
Yeah, so this project, like as you said, it would include one of the largest casinos in the state. So that would also mean, you know, 45,000 square feet of convention space. It would have a 40,000 square foot indoor water park and also a 300 room hotel. You know, it's going to be just west of I-39 and 90, just north of the Illinois border. And, you know, it's expected to create 1,500 permanent jobs and more than 2,000 construction jobs.
As I mentioned, this process started 9 years ago. It's not a quick thing to turn around a casino. A lot of steps along the way. What did it take to get where it is now?
Well, it took the U.S. Department of Interior approving the project, for one thing. They placed or are placing 32 acres of land in Beloit in trust for the new casino. And they signed off on that last year. And then, you know, it also needed Governor Evers' approval, you know, because governors have to sign off on off-reservation casinos, or they have the power to approve or block those projects. And so this was a big step forward for the tribe this week.
What was the local response from leaders in the Beloit area, Rock County, to the proposal?
Yeah, well, city and county leaders are pretty excited about this project in terms of the revenue that this is going to create for them, the increase in tourism, and also, you know, the job creation that this is going to bring to the local community and be an economic boost for the region. You know, on that shared revenue piece, they have reached an agreement, an intergovernmental agreement with the Ho-Chunk Nation, where the city and county are each going to get 2% of the net win from this casino. And that would be split with about 70% of those revenues going to the city and 30% going to the county.
Speaking of revenues, Danny, I understand that a lot of casinos, I guess it seems obvious, they've taken a big hit from COVID. What do we know about how that's affected the casino economy here in the state?
Yeah, well, they've been hit really hard. You know, as you know, COVID-19, you know, shut down gaming operations for months last year, and that even caused some tribes to lay off a large number of employees. You know, for example, Forest County Pottawatomie has seen more than $100 million in economic losses. And the majority of that is because of tribal gaming revenues that were lost from the shutdowns. And the nonpartisan Wisconsin Policy Forum released a report earlier this year that found those state payments that they have, where tribes in the state have gaming compacts, you know, those payments that are made to the state went down about 82%. And so really, the state could see a loss of around $70 million over last year, this year, and the next.
Talking to WPR reporter Danielle Kading about the governor signing off on a plan for a new casino, a Ho-Chunk Casino in Beloit. Now, Danny, it was just a few years back that then-Governor Scott Walker had rejected a Menominee tribe plan for a casino over in Kenosha. Can you remind us why he was against that particular project?
Yeah, so former Governor Scott Walker rejected the Menominee Tribe's plans for that facility because at the time he feared that the state may lose its share of revenues from Forest County Pottawatomie's casino in Milwaukee. The thought there being that potentially the state could lose around $100 million in payments if Kenosha's casino cut into Forest County Pottawatomie's casino's business in Milwaukee. There was also some speculation, too, that, you know, that decision was political because at the time Walker was running for president and some conservatives in Iowa had, you know, asked Walker to avoid an expansion of gaming. And so I believe the tribe at the time and also some Democrats pointed to that as being part of the reason why he made that decision.
And as you mentioned, there was a concern in that Kenosha case that a new tribal casino could impact the business of already existing tribal casinos. Do we know with this Beloit proposal how other tribes, especially tribes that operate casinos elsewhere in the state, have felt about this one?
Well, Ryan Greendeer said, you know, the Ho-Chunk Nation's public relations officer, he said the other day that Forest County Pottawatomie, that they work together and they talk about things. And this is one of the things that they've discussed. And he says that they've supported the tribe's plan to build the casino complex. So I'm not hearing about any opposition so far.
Last year, as we've mentioned, the Department of Interior approved this Beloit project. The governor now is on board. What is next? Are there still more approval steps?
Yeah, so they still have to get final approval from the U.S. Department of Interior. You know, they have to officially place that land in trust for the new casino. And then, you know, once they approve or sign off on that, then Governor Evers and the tribe would have to sit down and renegotiate their gaming compact because that would likely include new revenues from this casino.
So assuming that all those approvals make it through, then what's the timeline from building something like this until the doors open up?
Well, it's kind of in limbo right now because the tribe hasn't yet finalized their designs or their plans. But I know that city leaders are hoping that construction will start within the next year. They think that that's a realistic timeline. And I believe the tribe is planning to start construction on that casino portion of the project first.
Danny, thanks a lot for joining us again.
Yeah, thanks for having me on, Rob.
Danielle Kading is a WPR reporter. We talked to her about the Ho-Chunk Nation's plans for a casino complex in Beloit and Governor Evers' approval of that project this week. Coming up, a new study looks at chronic neurological symptoms that sometimes show up in patients who had a mild case of COVID-19. That's coming up next here on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. Today at 6 on 1A+, after two deadly shootings in under a week, the president takes questions from the press about what action he plans to take next. In the Senate, its majority leader says it's time for Congress to act. The number of daily COVID cases is up. The numbers dying from the disease continues to tick down. Jen White gets to all of it on the Friday News Roundup. That's today at 6 on 1A+. Now, a new study looks at people who have developed long-term neurological symptoms after having, in some cases, a mild bout of COVID-19. A study from Northwestern University looked at a group of 100 people who had COVID cases that didn't send them to the hospital, but then eventually morphed into ongoing neurological symptoms, including headaches, brain fog, muscle pain, tingling, dizziness, and more. Emerging research is finding some connections between relatively mild cases of COVID and long-term symptoms from the illness. We're looking at new research on so-called long COVID and the neurological symptoms that can sometimes come along with it. Dr. Edith Graham is an instructor of neurology and a fellow in neuroimmunology at Northwestern's Feinberg School of Medicine. She sees patients in the university's NeuroCOVID clinic, which is established in response to patients with long-term neurological symptoms after COVID. She's a co-author of this new study. Dr. Graham, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Hi, Rob. Thank you. It's great to be here.
Can you tell us, first of all, about, I gave a short list of symptoms there, but about some of the things that people are showing up with after, as we said, a mild case of COVID?
Absolutely. So it was very evident to us early in the pandemic that even these patients who were having very mild illnesses, and by mild, I mean patients who did not require oxygen. So maybe they felt very sick at home, like a very bad flu-like illness, but they didn't require oxygen or hospitalization. But they were coming in and they were ending up in a neurology clinic because they had what they were describing as brain fog or problems with their thinking, their concentration. And that was the first thing that we realized was this was really going to be an issue going forward.
And I know it's probably hard to tell this at this point, but do we know how common this is among people who have had, as you say, COVID, but not at a level of hospitalization?
Yeah, like you said, the numbers are still emerging on what percent of patients who have had COVID go on to develop long COVID. And at this point, I think the number is kind of estimated around 10% of patients.
And can you talk about the severity here? Because I think people might hear brain fog and, oh, we all feel that a little bit from time to time. Can you talk about the severity of the patients who are coming to your neuro-COVID clinic with these symptoms?
Yeah, that's an excellent question. So, right, it's something that I think people hear, they dismiss, but really we are seeing this have quite an impact on people in their work and their jobs. They're not able to go back to work, sometimes for 3 weeks, but sometimes for months. And these are people who were previously healthy, had no prior medical conditions, and they are really struggling. And why that is and the root of all of this and the mechanism we're still researching and learning more about.
Right. This is an elusive illness. At first we thought respiratory, but then we saw it had issues with the cardiovascular system, our blood vessels, our hearts, the blood vessels in our lungs. What are we seeing when it comes to damage to, I don't know, our nerves, our brains?
Yeah, no, exactly. This is something that it seems to be able to really affect any organ system that we have. So with our brains, so of our patient population, we looked at 100 patients who came to us in our outpatient clinic with any of the neurologic symptoms you listed. But of our patients, 81% had brain fog, 68% had headaches. And again, we're talking not just a mild headache here. We're talking chronic, persistent migraines, really debilitating, unable to do anything but kind of tend to their headache. Numbness and tingling, disorders still persistent, anosmia or loss of smell, loss of taste, are probably some of the most common things that we're seeing.
I guess one question I'd have is somebody that condition, does that mean they still have an active viral infection going on, or is this a consequence of damage received while they were suffering from COVID? How do we start to answer a question like that?
Right. And honestly, it may be neither. Right. So I don't think we have any good evidence to date that that COVID actively infects the brain. So there's no, in other words, we don't see the COVID virus in our neurons. There is also some evidence, you know, that there is potentially some damaging sequelae of like microscopic blood clots that may form in the brain. But honestly, I think it's probably a third option, which is a persistent autoimmune or a disimmune activation that occurs after being exposed to the virus.
That sounds bad to me, because it seems like autoimmune disorders, for people who have suffered for them for a long time, they know this, they're really hard to treat. Is that fair to say?
Yeah. I mean, autoimmune disorders can come in multiple different types. So there's many components of our immune system. So based on which part of it is affected, it depends on what the treatment's going to be. And so until we can really nail down that this might be a specific antibody or specific receptor, then it's really difficult to have any sort of targeted treatment.
We're talking about possible long-term neurological symptoms that follow COVID-19 infection, often even in just mild cases of COVID-19. Dr. Edith Graham is with us. She is a researcher. She's written about this. She's with Northwestern University's Feinberg School of Medicine. Dr. Graham, you have focused on people who had mild cases of COVID. Do we know, have we seen similar things that you're aware of in people who have had more severe cases, who have been, for example, hospitalized due to COVID complications?
Yeah, absolutely. We're actually going to be coming out with another cohort of looking at those patients who have been hospitalized. But from my personal experience, we've seen over 400 patients now in our neuro-COVID clinic, many of which were hospitalized. And yes, the symptoms seem to be very similar.
Now, you're looking for this at Northwestern. Are you hearing from colleagues around the country saying, yes, we're seeing these things too?
Absolutely. I think one of the other early clinics to start a neuro-COVID model was Mount Sinai. And they definitely are seeing very similar rates of these problems going on there.
Now, I wonder, Dr. Graham, there were a lot of, especially early on, at least it's thought that there were a lot of undiagnosed cases of COVID-19 where somebody may have had it, a mild case, they didn't get tested for it. Is it possible that there are people out there who might be having these same conditions and not even thinking it might be from COVID?
That's a very interesting question. You know, it's going to be hard to know if that's the case without, particularly if I've had some people ask me, you know, I tested positive for COVID antibodies and I didn't even know I had it. But now I'm thinking, you know, I've had some problems with my memory over the past few months. Could that be from an asymptomatic COVID infection? And we don't know. I think the research is focusing right now on people who have had symptoms and come to our attention, but we are certainly looking at both people who have tested positive and people who have tested negative but had COVID symptoms to kind of characterize what's still going on.
Let's bring on a caller. We've got Dennis with us in Two Rivers. Dennis, hi.
Hi. Yeah, I was thinking of pretty much what you were just talking about is, because I've had trouble with brain fog for quite a while due to stress and whatever else. The thing is, I'm under treatment. So how do I know if I'm recovering from what I had before, but now maybe I have some asymptomatic COVID-19 because I don't have the coughing or the other things, but maybe the brain fog is coming up?
Dennis, thanks a lot for the call. So that's interesting, Dr. Graham, somebody who might have, maybe even in the pre-COVID era, had some of these symptoms. Maybe Dennis isn't sure if he had COVID, but I don't know, how do you sort out if COVID is causing new things or it's the old problem recurring?
Yeah, so, you know, there are multiple things that can cause brain fog, and certainly stress and other sorts of mood disorders, depression, anxiety would contribute to that. Any chronic illness or prior history of concussion would all contribute to feelings of brain fog. So, you know, we're not taking anybody who comes into the clinic who has had that complaint and saying, yes, this is COVID, just because COVID was so prevalent this year. But it's worthwhile looking for an antibody and seeing, you know, is that something that's possibly there? And like I said, ultimately, I don't know if we can ever kind of retrospectively diagnose people who we weren't sure early in the pandemic.
Thanks for that call, Dennis. Now, I've read that there have been anecdotal reports of some people, again, post-COVID, developing symptoms of psychosis, who had never had that or never had that diagnosed before. Is that something that you've encountered in your own research?
Yeah, surprisingly, we have had a couple of patients who have endorsed episodes of hallucinations. And typically more acutely during the phase of the illness where they were pretty sick with the flu-like symptoms. We haven't seen patients who have had, I guess, prolonged psychosis, kind of more maybe like fever dreams would be a better word for it, where they had these kind of transient hallucinations. You know, I'm not a psychiatrist, but I think that is a worthwhile area to explore the effect of COVID-inducing psychosis.
I almost feel bad for asking this early in the research, but are there any thoughts as to treatments for those people who, again, had that mild case of COVID, they're having these long-term neurological symptoms, the brain fog and headaches and things like that? Do we have therapies in mind for them?
Yeah, no, no, do not feel bad for asking about that. I think that's the question on everybody's mind too, especially those who come to see us. So there haven't been any specific clinical trials in these patients to see what works and what doesn't work, which would be necessary. But at this point, we've had kind of mixed results with patients who have been treated with steroids, for example. Some patients actually feel much worse when they take steroids. So maybe that goes against the hypothesis that this could be something autoimmune. But for the short term, what we're doing is we're treating patients symptomatically for their fatigue, for their headaches, if they have painful kind of tingling or neuropathy, and those sorts of things.
I'm hoping for the best for the patients you're working with. What are you watching for over time to see, you know, if they stay with this condition, get better, get worse? What kind of things do you have your eye on?
Yeah, at this point, you know, I think we were hopeful early in the pandemic that people were all going to be on a positive trajectory and all improving. And some patients do, but there's still a subset of patients who we're finding do not improve or have a fluctuating course. And even one year later, we're seeing that some of these patients just aren't improving. So I think we're doing a follow-up study with our patients at 9 to 12 months after to see what their current status is. But also, I'm looking forward to more research kind of elucidating what's happening on a cellular level in these patients to cause these symptoms.
Dr. Graham, we'll leave it there. Thanks for sharing your research with us.
Thank you so much for having me.
That's Dr. Edith Graham, instructor of neurology at Northwestern's Feinberg School of Medicine. She's a co-author of a new study on long-term neurological impacts of COVID-19, even for some people who had mild cases of the illness. Weekdays from 6 to 9 a.m., it's the morning show, Monday at 7. Hear from two state senators, a Democrat and a Republican, about some of the top issues facing Wisconsin, including the future of the state budget. That's Monday at 7 on the morning show. Coming up next, it's news from NPR and Wisconsin Public Radio. Then an epidemiologist takes us on a tour through the history of vaccines and the anti-vaccine movements that arose along with them. I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network.